last one for oral argument in April. It's 98-0273-CR State v. James E. Erickson, appearing for the State of Wisconsin, Assistant Attorney General Paul Lunston. Ms. Lunston, we talked about you this morning.
I was listening.
Good.
Chief Justice, members of the court, the defendant in this case was tried and convicted of child enticement. During jury selection, the trial judge gave both the defendant and the state less peremptory strikes than he should have under the peremptory strike statute. The defendant claims that this error is cause for, in a phrase you've heard too many times lately, I suspect, automatic reversal. I'll briefly summarize the facts. The defendant was charged with child enticement and also secondary sexual assault of a child. Importantly, he was charged as a persistent repeater. He had two prior child sexual assault convictions dating back to 1988, or 89 and 91. His persistent repeater status meant that if he was convicted, he would face a penalty of life without parole. And in turn, this meant, under the peremptory strike statute, that he was entitled to six peremptory strikes, both sides entitled to six peremptory strikes rather than four. And there was another factor in this case: the judge impaneled an additional juror, and that meant that they should receive one more peremptory strikes. The net effect, the defendant and the state were entitled to seven peremptory strikes. The judge granted them four. Now, the participants apparently realized that this was a problem. There was no objection. And then I would contend that the defendant was convicted, and it preceded the post-conviction post-conviction process. And then I contend something very notable happened. Perhaps for the first time in history, Mr. Cushing detected this error. So far as the collective memory of my unit at the Department of Justice can recall, no one has ever raised this challenge before. And the question is, why? And the simple answer is Ramos. The reason that his attention was focused on the peremptory strike topic was that after Ramos, for the first time in this state's history, if he found a problem with peremptory strikes, he might get his client a new trial automatically. And I think that's important because of what didn't draw his attention to it, and what didn't apparently draw the attention of prior appellate counsel and prior attorneys. And that's the importance of the exact number of peremptory strikes. The importance of the exact number of peremptory strikes would have existed prior to Ramos. The importance of peremptory strikes was there. But we didn't have appellate attorneys scrutinizing for errors in that regard because they just didn't perceive that the loss of one or more peremptory strikes or the exact number of peremptory strikes was a critical issue. So I'll, returning to the facts briefly, I should say that important to this case is that the defendant's trial counsel was not aware of the statute, did not make a strategic decision to forego an objection, and would have liked to have had at least one more peremptory strike. There was someone who went on to this jury that should not have been removed for cause. There was no question about that. This was not someone who should have been removed for cause. They don't claim that this juror was biased. But this was someone that the defense attorney had good reason to have a hunch about, good reason to suspect might be a problem juror. And he listed good reasons for that at the post-conviction hearing. So it's important to remember that the defense attorney in this case didn't make a strategic decision not to object. First thing I want to talk about is a proper framework for analysis. And this needs to be addressed because the defense attorney is saying that you ought to skip over any question of deficient performance. You shouldn't address it under a Strickland prejudice analysis. You should just go straight to a Ramos-type analysis and just find automatic reversal, automatic prejudice. I submit that that is not an appropriate way to handle this type of case. This is a very normal sort of situation. Very normal. A judge or a prosecutor makes a mistake. Something happened. Something at trial went wrong. The defense attorney failed to object. And the way this court normally treats that situation is under an ineffective assistance of counsel analysis, because we want defense attorneys to be vigilant, because we want to promote an error-free trial the first time. So we put the burden on defendants under Strickland to meet those two prongs. And I also want to point out, it might not be apparent, because in this case, there was no strategic decision not to object. But that might not always be true. It would be easy to conceive of a situation where a defense attorney might intentionally sit back, and perhaps because they're happy with the jurors that are there, perhaps they're so happy they'd like to limit the number of strikes that the prosecutor might exercise, and they might intentionally remain silent. And in that situation, I don't think we would want to grant the defendant a new trial under an automatic reversal rule. We wouldn't want him to make a strategic decision to go with fewer jurors or fewer peremptory strikes and then grant a new trial.
Do you have to exercise your peremptory strikes? You can just say, I have no more strikes. I waive them all, can't you?
You could forego them, but then you couldn't deprive the state of exercising their peremptory strikes. The state would still have...
I understand that. I've always had a little difficulty when I've read the statutes to figure out how many peremptory strikes everybody has. Why is it so complicated?
Maybe I've read it too many times now, and it seems straightforward to me now. I agree the first time I read it, it was complicated, and
yeah,
I don't know why.
I've given a number of speeches on this, and I always say, well, it's covered by the statute, and I don't want to get into it, because I just never am sure that I'm reading it right.
But I don't think this is a problem of the statute being unclear. I think the parties just didn't care. I mean, it wasn't a big issue to them exactly how many peremptory strikes were given.
Why can't everybody just get three? Or two. I mean, pick a number, and then why does it have to vary? I know it's legislative, but I mean, is there a sensible reason or rationale in the statutes? I just haven't bothered to look.
No, the number four has been the same. The sort of baseline number for felony cases has been the same since we became a state. That dates back to 1849 or 8, whatever it is. But it's not a magical number, because when you look at the number of strikes granted for life cases or for multiple defendants, that number has gone up and down. And generally speaking, it's gone down. It used to be with multiple defendants in a life case, you could get up to 48 peremptory strikes. So there's been quite a change in that. I don't think there's any magical number. I don't think states are consistent about how many they give.
What appears to be magical is, though, that there be an equality of strikes, number of strikes. Do you agree with that?
I think that's an important... Well, I'm not sure exactly how to answer that. One thing I have to be candid about is that it hasn't always been equal. If you go back far enough, the defendant was given more peremptory strikes than the state. So it hasn't always been exactly...
Under the current statute, and under apparently our case law now, that the import is that there be an opportunity for an equal number of strikes. How about that? Do you agree with that?
Well, it's tempting for me to say that equality is the key issue, because I would win this case.
I know, that's where I was going with... Why don't you jump on board?
But because I spend almost all my time doing these kind of cases, I know that there are other cases out there in another kind of context where a defense attorney arguably has performed efficiently, resulting in a defendant getting one less peremptory strike from the state. And actually, in my view, this is the easy situation. This is a situation where both sides receive the same number of peremptory strikes. And yes, we maintain the level playing field.
I mean, that's one of the... What I was doing was, you know, tossing you a ball to hit, because, I mean, that is one of the distinguishing features, of course, from the case that we addressed previously today, and I saw you sitting here, so I know that you were listening to that. It's one of the distinguishing features of perhaps of Ramos, where there is an argument that there wasn't an equality of peremptory strikes and the way the Court of Appeals in the last case interpreted the statute, that has to be an equality based on Ramos. That's what they said. But here, so what's to complain, you should be arguing? There's an equality, right?
I should be if I was narrowly focused on this particular
case. Okay, that's the answer. There's so many of these cases in the pipeline that you're not.
Yes, and
if you're just on this case, that would be your argument.
Yes, if this was the only... Yes. And that would be a very strong argument in this case. And I do make it in my brief. I don't disavow it. But what I would hope is that the court would entertain the notion that put aside for another day the question of whether, if you have a situation where there's an inequality in the number of peremptory strikes, if an error by a trial attorney leads to an inequality in strikes, I hope you would put aside for another day what decision you might reach in that case, because
well,
I think
we got that alleged in the case that was argued at 11 o'clock. The defendants claimed that they had four or less peremptory strikes in the state.
Well, that's a very good point, and another day would suggest that
maybe
another
part of the day.
While,
maybe another day has come.
Well, wait a minute.
But if your view, Justice Babbage, prevails, or I don't know what your view is, but if a view reflected in one of your questions were to prevail, which I personally think is the correct view.
A correct or incorrect?
The correct view. The correct view. There was an error this morning in that case that trial judges have the discretion to very liberally grant strikes.
Well, you can't use the word discretion, because that's not what the proposal was. The proposal was that there was absolute right of a judge, not discretionary right.
Well, I don't agree to the extent that your question suggests a position that extreme. I don't agree with it. I don't think a judge has an absolute right to reject people willingly. I think that there's a due process restraint on it. If there's an indication that a trial judge is favoring, has a systematically favoring the prosecution or the defense, then I think you have a problem.
Systematic would be a number of cases and keeping those kind of records. You know, that's an almost impossible burden. It's almost impossible in race, let alone something that would be less easily defined.
Yeah. Well, my response to that is twofold. You're right that it makes a very difficult burden for defendants, and in fact it does in some of the cases.
Or for the state.
And for the state is always sort of out of luck in these cases.
Would you use the words largely unfettered discretion or something like that?
No, I don't know that particular label makes a difference. I think the proper control on the judge's exercise of discretion is a due process control. And I think in some cases, you can see in a particular case where the judge, does deliberately grant strikes for one side and not the other.
I mean, or a strike based upon, as Justice Simons pointed out this morning, race, gender, whatever.
And you see a skewed view of what goes on at the trial court level. I submit there are a lot of judges who are inclined to strike police officers, who are inclined to strike people just based on a sort of category that they're in because they want to avoid the appearance of bias. And if you...
Why are we arguing that case now? With all due respect, Mr. Lunston, and I led you into that, too. How about I have a focus on this case? In this case, an argument... One of my problems with the argument that you're advancing for this case is... that you rely on the second prong of the Strickland test.
Yes.
And you say, well, there's no showing of prejudice. And I note that the problem I have is I think it's an almost impossible burden to show prejudice. I mean, even in your argument, in your brief, it's highly speculative whether a denial of equal number of preempting strikes to both the defense and the prosecution resulted in harm to the defendant. How is a defendant ever supposed to show that, especially to the burden that you set forth on page 14? A defendant must establish that there's a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's unprofessional error, the result of the proceeding would have been different. To a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine the confidence in the outcome of the case. It's a high burden, and we're dealing with something I think it's almost impossible to prove. And so it seems a little unfair to me.
Well, I don't think you should decide what test to apply based upon whether or not a defendant has a fair chance of winning, or the state has a fair chance of winning. I mean, the Strickland test is a proper test to apply in this sort of situation, I think, because it is.
If you go with that, then you don't have to even bother with the Ramos.
And the fact that the defendant, hasn't any chance, the class of defendants that we have here don't have any chance of winning, to me, doesn't highlight the problem with the test. It highlights the fact that they were not harmed.
Well, if a test is virtually impossible to pass, it seems like it might be a little unfair.
Well, I don't follow your logic. I mean, to me...
Well, let's say you set up a test, and it's... I use the term... And you can't make that. You just can't pass it. Let's say one in a million chances. I think that's a fair test. Or you're saying it's irrelevant if it's fair.
I think you judge whether a test is fair by looking at the test itself and deciding whether it's a fair test. I don't know if this will be helpful or not, but let me talk about the Damask case that we talk about in the briefs. That's a case where if a defense attorney negligently fails to request substitution of a judge, then a defendant is going to be stuck with a different test, with a Strickland test on appeal. If, on the other hand, the defense attorney had preserved the objection, made it in a timely way, and for some other reason the judge erred and didn't grant substitution, then you have a different test. Then you have an automatic reversal rule on that situation. The defendant automatically is entitled to a new proceeding. For a class of defendants, they will never be able to meet the Strickland prejudice test established in that case. For a class of defendants, a very large class, they don't have a reason to complain about the particular judge that rises to the level of prejudice. The reason they wanted to substitute on that judge was the reason most defendants want to substitute on a judge, and that's because they have the judge has a reputation of being a harsh sentencer or a harsh judge to defendants. So the reason that they wanted to substitute is lost. They have no chance of showing prejudice on appeal, and in that situation we apply the Strickland prejudice test. Even though a huge class of defendants have no chance at all of meeting the test. And I submit that the reason is because if you preserve error, then that leads you to one analysis. That typically ends up putting the burden on the state with preserved error, as it should be when a defendant objects. But when a defendant fails to object and allows error to happen inadvertently, then we apply the Strickland test. For all the policy reasons, we have Strickland. And those policy reasons that we have, the Strickland approach, apply in this case. And just because the defendant in this class of defendant can't meet the prejudice prong doesn't mean that the whole structure is wrong.
Did the defendant fail to object in Farron?
Pardon me?
Did the defendant fail to object in the Farron case?
No, I believe Farron was preserved there. The defendant did object.
I asked the question not knowing the answer, and I just don't.
Yeah, and since it was my case, I should know it very quickly, but sometimes the case is mush.
We understand the feeling, Counsel.
How do you feel about Ramos?
Is that the one you said was the most important case you ever argued?
Well,
Ramos
set the scene for my most important case. At the time I argued with Ramos, I didn't know it was.
Mr. Lundstedt, let me ask you, why aren't you writing the argument of waiver here? Why are you not writing the argument of waiver here?
Well, I am, and I'm saying that the defendant's waiver is why you need to address it in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. It's the waiver that leads to the ineffective assistance.
Why couldn't you just take the approach that since no objection was made, there was a waiver, end of case? Why do you have to go on to ineffective assistance of counsel?
Because that's how you handle those sorts of situations. The defendant's claim is that he was disadvantaged because his attorney screwed up. And if an attorney does screw up, then I think a defendant shouldn't be stuck with a waiver. It's not fair to the defendant to stick them with the consequences of an ineffective attorney if that prejudices them. So if you have deficient performance and you have prejudice under Strickland, I think a defendant ought to receive relief.
How difficult do you think it would be in the normal situation to show prejudice?
Well, for this class of cases,
right.
I think it's impossible. I think under Strickland prejudice analysis, he cannot show prejudice for the very reason that he was not prejudiced.
So this is really another way of getting around Ramos.
Well, what I'm saying is that the different context of the two cases sets the scene for a different test. In Ramos, the defense attorney did exactly what he should have done. He objected. He asked that trial judge to reread the what was said. Couldn't have done more, and the trial judge made a mistake. The defense attorney did everything they should have done, and it was appropriate to put the burden on the state in that case. Whether it was appropriate for us to lose is another matter, but it was a different context. And here we have waiver. Here we have a defense attorney who didn't do what they should have done and who screwed up.
Now, excluding the waiver, isn't that a reason for arguing the difference between this case, where there was this mutual mistake, and the Ramos case, which was just starkly obvious that when it was called to the judge's attention, she said no, and it was, counsel did everything they could in that case. And that's what I think, but you don't have to use waiver because you have a difference of how these cases came together. And that's what I'm talking about, this case versus Ramos.
Yes.
Let's just double back again. There was a Mockner hearing here?
There was.
That's why you have to reach ineffective assistance of counsel unless you get rid of this case otherwise, because that was raised in the trial court post-conviction hearing, right?
Yes.
Okay. So in this case, you would argue that there was waiver, that raised ineffective assistance of counsel, and you would say no prejudice.
I'd say no prejudice.
And you get around Ramos and the Warning case by saying you got equality of opportunity here. Both of them got too few, but they were equal. So it was a statutory violation for both of them, but they came out even. I mean, that's one argument. It's not your favorite one.
Yeah, I mean, I use the words of the Strickland prejudice test to reach that result, but yes, that is the bottom line.
Now, let's just change the facts a bit. Suppose here the defendant got up and said in trial, I'm entitled to 7. You're giving me 4, Judge, but I'm entitled to 7, and that's true under section whatever it is. And the judge says, I don't read the statute that way. Maybe wrong, but she doesn't read it that way. I'm giving you 4. I'm giving the state 4. I think that's applicable here. And the counsel persists and says, I think you're wrong, Your Honor, and I'm preserving this error. Not that he has to say that, but anyway, he does. So now we're here on a different case where it is no waiver, so we don't ever get to ineffective assistance of counsel. How would you argue that one? Would you say Ramos applies?
I would concede error in that case because the defendant has...
Yeah, we concede error. There's error here, too, but the question is, what do you do about it? I mean, in all these cases, there may be error, or may not be, but if there's error, the issue in these cases is always the remedy. Isn't that right?
Well,
what do you do about it?
I think the proper analysis is the issue, and how you should analyze these cases under the criteria you've set forth in prior cases.
Okay, so what would you do in this case where there's no waiver?
In your hypothetical case, I would say that you would have to go back and say that it's governed by Ramos, because the defendant preserved the error, he objected. And as long as Ramos is good law, and which may be my full lifetime, that would govern.
So then you'd have to give him a new trial, in my hypothesis.
Yes.
Okay. And you'd say, if that were the second case that came up here, Ramos is first, then we've got a no-waiver case. Now we're dealing with your case on waiver. And you'd say it's not governed by the other two. Is that your point?
It's right. Because of the waiver that we do have, it leads to a different analysis. And the Strickland prejudice test, if properly applied, leads to a different result.
Okay, now suppose a case relates to something that's uneven, where the trial judge errs and says the state gets 5, the defendant gets 4. They're both supposed to get 7 under the statute. And defense hasn't waived it and persists in saying, 1, it's not equal, and 2, it's against the statute. So how would you analyze that case?
I think that I would have to say that the defendant would be hard-pressed to show prejudice under those facts. But I think that you might have, in that case, apart from this sort of challenge, you might well have a due process challenge, that when a judge gives, on the front side, a different number of peremptory strikes, that's a due process violation.
Yeah. It's a quality issue, especially if the statute doesn't grant that.
I think so.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lunston. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Could I ask you one question? Should Juror Lange have been removed for cause?
No. As I've laid out in my brief, I think that was... I can understand why Mr. Cushing raised that issue, given the current environment, but I think it's a very clear case of a judge properly exercising discretion. That juror initially expressed some reservations about her prior experience and how that might affect her during the trial, but went on then to provide very clear assurances that she would try and do her best. I believe I can is the words that she used. And the trial judge was there to hear those words, and he made findings that this juror was not emotional, and even made good findings on these facts, that this juror did not appear to him to be having a problem with that prior experience. So I think it's a very clear-cut case with respect to that challenge.
She said, I think so at one point.
Pardon me?
She said, I think so at one point. That's all right. We'll check it. Mr. Cushing, Assistant State Public Defender, representing James E. Erickson.
Yes, good afternoon. May it please the Court. I am Glenn Cushing, and I do represent Mr. Erickson today. I represent the defendant, the respondent in this court, and also the cross-appellant. Time permitting, I may address my cross-appeal briefly, but if I don't get there, I will rest on the brief with regard to that issue. I have requested the court to consider this issue in two different contexts. The first is to just address it as a due process violation without considering the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. This court has done that in the past in cases in which ineffective assistance of counsel was raised, but this court determined that the issue warranted being addressed directly on the merits. In State versus Walker, which involved a failure of a defense attorney to raise a Batson objection, I believe that case was certified here because of the problems in determining prejudice under those circumstances. This court ultimately decided to just address the issue directly. It is within this court's discretion to do that, and obviously the issue is more appropriately addressed as an ineffective assistance of counsel issue. That's how I litigated it, but this court's jurisprudence allows it to decide an issue if it feels that it is appropriate to do so, if it's an issue of law, if it has been fully briefed, and if the interests of justice warrant that type of a resolution. So this court has the authority to reach the issue directly and avoid this entanglement about the prejudice aspect of the case.
What's the issue that we should decide that would avoid that kind of entanglement?
I believe that this court said in Ramos that, and I'm paraphrasing, basically. The denial, the arbitrary denial or impairment of the right to exercise a peremptory challenge is reversible error without a showing of prejudice. Now, that statement is equally applicable to this case. And I know that normally the Strickland test requires the defendant to show prejudice. But there are numerous exceptions to that rule which allow the court to presume prejudice in appropriate circumstances.
But Ramos ended up with the defendant effectively being denied one less peremptory than the state. That didn't happen here.
No, my defendant was denied three peremptories in a case in which he was facing life without parole. And in a case in which he had numerous problems selecting a jury, two jurors he attempted to strike for cause that were denied, four other jurors that were stricken for cause by the judge, and he ended up with the foreperson of this jury being a woman who had been sexually assaulted as a child, who had worked for the police department, whose witnesses were testifying at the trial. So to me, it's too facile to say that the issue is, did both sides get the same number of peremptories? I don't believe that's the issue. The issue is, was the defendant's right to exercise his peremptories denied or impaired? Case law is almost uniform. This court did not write Ramos in a vacuum. And maybe you'll be happy to hear someone here who's not asking you to overrule Ramos. Ramos is consistent with the vast majority of cases which have decided that issue. You didn't make this up. This is the rule in federal court. This is the rule in the Seventh Circuit. This is a rule in at least half, if not a vast majority of the states. This is the rule. It's an automatic reversal. The United States Supreme Court said that in Swain, and they said it in Lewis, which is from, 1892. So I think what I'd like to do is kind of to focus the court's attention on the importance of peremptory challenges and the reason why we have this rule that says you don't have to show prejudice. There's a reason for that rule, and obviously it's partially because it's so difficult to do. In fact, it is impossible to show the type of prejudice that the state is trying to make me show. And first of all, I don't believe that Strickland should not be interpreted, it has not been interpreted by this court, as simply outcome determinative. That would require me to show, for instance, that Mr. Erickson would be acquitted if he were tried over again. I can't show that. But that isn't what Strickland has been interpreted to require. And that's a too narrow view of the prejudice. So my position is perhaps I can show prejudice under Strickland, but if I can't, then I need you to presume it based on the rationale of Ramos and all the cases that Ramos is based on, because I can't show what would have happened in that jury room if the woman who my trial attorney testified he would have removed with his peremptories if he'd had the three extra, he would have removed the person who ended up being the foreperson of the jury, this individual who had previously been the victim of the sexual assault. And the argument, and I don't want to argue the case from earlier this morning, but Chief Justice Abramson said, I would strike that juror that had a conviction for possession of cocaine because this is the same trial. Well, that's not really the rule in this state. And I never have argued that this foreperson should have been struck or could have been for cause based on disabling her because of her status as the victim of a sexual assault. There's a lot of law that says you can't do that. But this is the reason we have peremptories. And it, in addition to allowing a defendant to be satisfied with his jury, even if you cannot show that the jury is somehow partial or that some juror that should have been struck for cause was left on the jury, it's the defendant's right to be satisfied with the jury that he has. And that's why the peremptory challenges are so critical, because they allow him to do that without any reason, because someone looks at him wrong out of the corner of his eyes. But here, we don't even have to go to those types of extremes, because here you have a juror that clearly the defendant would have used an extra peremptory on.
But you are arguing, just for a moment, you are arguing that she should have been struck for cause because
on the basis of her answers, she could not be impartial.
That's a different juror.
I understand.
That's a different juror.
That's Miss Lang.
We have to keep trying to keep this. Yeah, because what happened was there was a juror named Lang. The defendant moved to strike her for cause. She was there were. So the court is aware there were three, four, or five people on this jury panel who had been the victims of sexual assault as children, in their, and so there was a problem.
Not a per se exclusion, but it can be.
Can be for cause if the record supports it. He moved to strike two jurors for cause, not the one that remained on as the foreperson. There was no challenge to her for cause.
That's Lang.
No, that's Bowman.
Bowman was the foreperson.
Yes. Juror Bowman was the foreperson. That's the juror that the defense attorney identified as the juror he would have struck with a peremptory if he had had his full complement of peremptories. Juror Lang also was the victim of a sexual assault as a child. She indicated at first that it would be might be hard for her. She wasn't sure if she could be fair. There was additional questioning of her. The final question was, well, can you put all this aside and decide this case on the basis of the evidence? And her answer was, I think so. The motion to strike her for cause was denied. The defendant used a peremptory to remove her from the jury. So that's a separate issue. That's the Farron issue that exists in this case. It's wholly separate from the problem, although it's all related, that the defendant, first of all, is denied, you know, almost half of his peremptories in what I consider to be the closest thing we have to the death penalty in Wisconsin. And this individual is in prison for life without parole. No questions, no discretion by the sentencing judge. That's it. So we give him more peremptories. When we asked about the reason for the numbers, I mean, I can't give you a reason for the precise numbers, but when you look at it, you get three if it's a misdemeanor, you get four if it's a felony, you get six if it's life in prison. Now, we don't, and you get an extra one then if additional jurors are selected.
So you're asking us for a rule of law, for a rule, that it is a violation of statutory due process whenever a defendant is denied the peremptories allowed by 97203.
Correct. That statute was construed by this court to be mandatory. The word, the language, Justice Steinmetz, in that decision decided that it says shall be entitled to, shall be allowed. It's a mandatory statute, and I think this court should just enforce it. And some cases will get reversed because of this error. To me, you know, the cases will be retried. The system will work the way it was designed to work. It's not a reason to overrule Ramos because some other cases that rely on Ramos will also result in reversals. These aren't windfalls. These are cases in which the procedures which the legislature designed to ensure a fair trial were not followed.
How many cases are there where there are problems about the number of peremptories? Is this a lot of cases?
They listed some in their brief. I believe they number seven.
How many?
Seven. There may be some others out there that are in the trial court stage. One of my other ones is listed in that list. I have no others. I don't know how many the office has, but there may be a few. It's not, you know, dozens or anything.
Well, and which category do they fall into? This category of waiver?
I believe most of them are cases in which they were inadvertently denied the correct number. Defense counsel was not aware of that. And my belief, I'd like to give the court maybe a structure for doing this. You didn't use this analysis in Ramos. You decided it's reversible error without a showing of prejudice. But there is, the United States Supreme Court has identified the types of issues that, to which harmless error is never applicable. And I guess what I'm trying to get to is a sense of the prejudice prong of an ineffective claim is like the other side of the coin of the harmless error issue. If the error is preserved, and I tried to argue this in my brief, when you have an error that's preserved, you don't get automatic reversal. There always has to be prejudice. It's not just in ineffective cases that there has to be prejudice. There always has to be prejudice for a reversal, or else it's harmless error. And so what I'm suggesting is that in cases in which you have identified an issue which can never be harmless, and there aren't that many of those types of issues, but this is one, This court has identified this issue as one which can never be harmless, along with the vast majority of courts that have done the same thing. If you have an issue which can never be harmless and which prejudice is presumed, in those types of cases, I think it's appropriate to presume prejudice in the Strickland analysis. When you're raising an ineffective case, if this court has already determined that this type of error can never be harmless, then isn't it always prejudicial? And just because the burden is shifted, now it's an impossible burden, I can't raise it, and my client gets no relief. And I think the court should also keep in mind that it's very difficult to have to lay the blame on defense counsel here. You know, if an objection is made and a trial judge erroneously denies a strike for cause, we don't call it ineffective judging. You know, he made a mistake. He made the ruling wrong. The error results in reversal. I have a defense attorney who made a mistake, but he was not the only one in that courtroom. The judge and the prosecutor also have an obligation to see to it that the law is applied fairly and properly. So that, I am in this context of ineffective assistance of counsel, and then I have all these hoops put in front of me that I need to jump through. But my position is that you've identified an issue, an error that can never be harmless. And you didn't use this analysis, but the Supreme Court did in Arizona versus Fulminante, in trying to decide whether a coerced confession admitted at trial could ever be harmless. They developed this trial error versus structural error dichotomy. And if it's a structural error, then it can never be harmless. If it's a trial error, it's subject to harmless error. And this is really what you did in Ramos. You didn't use those terms, but the analysis is basically the same. A trial error is one which occurs during the presentation of the case to the jury, and which may therefore be quantitatively assessed in the context of other evidence to determine whether the error was harmless. That's a trial error. A structural error affects the framework within which the trial proceeds, rather than an error in the trial itself. And it affects it's a defect in the constitution of the trial mechanism. And that's, I think, a label that fits what happened here appropriately. The denial of peremptories that occur when everyone misses the number is a structural error in the trial, and you can't really get at the prejudice. And so you need to give the defendant a new trial to make sure that we have fair proceedings. And this court has applied this analysis, not exactly in State versus Smith, which is in my brief, was a case in which this court presumed prejudice in an ineffective assistance of counsel case. It's a breach of a plea bargain where the state argued something they weren't supposed to. No objection. And on Strickland terms, you could do away with that issue by saying, well, the judge would have imposed the same sentence. There's no harm, no error, no prejudice. But this court recognized that it was appropriate to presume prejudice because you can't really prove it. You can't really get at the problem. And here, I think the prejudice is that you lose half of your peremptories. If we're true to the spirit of peremptories and how long they've been a part of the common law, and one of the cases, I think, in Batson itself, Chief Justice Berger traces it from the ancient Romans. You used to be able to have unlimited peremptories in order to assure a fair trial. We have whittled the number down and down and down. And I don't believe that we should allow it to arbitrarily be reduced in a trial just because the participants overlook it. Even though both sides got the same number, it really is more of an error here, more of a problem than what happened in Ramos. Well, because if you look at Ramos and the argument was, I believe, that peremptories are to ensure an impartial jury, and he used it to correct the trial court's error, so what's the problem? He corrected the error. He had all of his peremptories, at least. Ramos had all seven. Mr. Erickson only got four. If the purpose is to let him use them all, at least let him do that.
Well, now, with respect, I think I'm still on your statutory due process argument. Going forward momentarily to the juror Lange issue, you claim under that issue that you were denied your right to an impartial jury. Right?
Yes. That's the Ramos.
The Senate has a constitutional and statutory right to an impartial jury. That's
a Ramos issue, right, basically on its facts.
Now, are you claiming that here in this first, with respect to this first issue?
No.
So you had an impartial jury. Or at least you're conceding.
Right. I'm not claiming, neither issue is that he had, that the jury was not impartial. Neither one of the issues is a claim that that I was denied an impartial jury.
You argued that with respect to Lange.
No.
Subsection A, a criminal defendant has a constitutional and statutory right to an impartial jury.
Well, that's correct, but the rest of the argument is based on Ramos, which is you move to strike for cause, motion improperly denied, you use up a peremptory to remove the juror.
Yeah,
it's the same issue in Ramos.
No, but look, if she sat properly, then there's no Ramos issue.
Juror Lange was stricken from the jury by use of a peremptory. That's exactly what happened in Ramos. The juror he moved to strike the juror for cause. The judge says, no, I won't read back the transcript. Yeah, he then strikes that juror. So that juror is not on the panel. Ramos didn't claim that his jury was less than impartial, and I'm not either.
Both Justice Babbage, I shouldn't speak for Justice Babbage, but I mistaken the facts. She did not sit.
Lange did not sit, correct.
But what you're saying is that I don't want to put words in your mouth. Let me just stay on the first issue. You say that Juror Bowman, you were forced to keep her on the jury.
Right?
And she ended up being the foreperson, not you. Right.
Prevented from striking her because he ran out of peremptories.
But you don't raise the issue of an impartial jury.
Correct, because I don't claim that Juror Bowman was subject to a strike for cause. I've never claimed that. I've never claimed that Juror Bowman was subject to a strike for cause.
You would have might have stricken her had she had another
testimony was that he would have stricken her. He ran out of peremptories.
Now I get back to an argument that I heard this morning. You're claiming, at least by silence anyway, you had an impartial jury. And yet you're asking for an automatic reversal.
Correct.
Doesn't that strike you as being a little tinny?
Just like Ramos. That's the rule of Ramos, and that's the rule of the majority of courts that have ruled on this issue. The error is in the proceeding itself. And because you can't, this trial would have been tried by a different jury. The foreperson would have been off. If you get three extra peremptories each side, you start up there with a panel that has six more people to choose from than you had when you began. Each side would have seven strikes, that's 14. You have 13 jurors, so you'd have 27 people up there to pick from. When this happened, there were only 21 to pick from. But yeah, the answer to your question is yes. I am asking for a reversal because Mr. Erickson was deprived of what this court and the United States Supreme Court has continually referred to as one of the most important rights secured to the accused. So important that that the general rule is you get an automatic reversal.
When you talk about statutory due process, the way I interpret it, maybe that's not what you intended, is that a violation of a statute could violate due process.
Correct. That's the basis of my first argument.
That's what I understood.
That he was denied due process because this state gives him a right, a procedural right, and then denied it to him at the trial. And it's a very important trial, too. I don't think that your case should be determined just based on the seriousness of the crime, but certainly this court should keep in mind that, you know, this isn't a first offense OWI we're talking about here.
What about the concept? So you wouldn't treat this case any differently than if the counsel had objected?
That's one of my arguments. I'm prepared to concede that this court could require it to be analyzed under an ineffective claim. I've argued the ineffective claim. So what I'm saying is, you can do it this way. If you're going to do ineffective, here's the argument. So, yes, and I do think, and I want to address at least briefly this argument that somehow lawyers can know about this and sit on it and get automatic reversals. That's not a legitimate concern for this court. First of all, I think this court could require, whether it's going to analyze it in terms of due process or an ineffective claim, a normal ineffective claim, I would be required to show, and maybe this will answer Justice Crooks's question, to show that, yeah, this was waived. There was no objection. So normally it would be waived. But the doctrine of ineffective assistance of counsel says, well, look, waiver is a knowing and intelligent relinquishment of a known right. To not know what you're doing, to not understand the law, that's not waiver. That's deficient performance, as the U.S. Supreme Court and this court defines it. So that's not really, he's procedurally defaulted on the issue by not raising an objection. And the way I get at it is by having him testify that he didn't know what he was doing, and this lawyer did. Now, if a lawyer, you would have to believe that defense attorneys would perjure themselves on the witness stand at this type of a hearing to get to the point where you're reversing convictions where lawyers knew about it and sat on their rights. There are other doctrines to deal with that. The judicial estoppel, I mean, you can't take a position in the lower court and change it. If a lawyer knows he's happy with the jury, he says, for instance, well, you know, I didn't need any more peremptories. I knew I was entitled to seven, but I didn't want them. That raises a different question in a different case than what you have presented here. This lawyer candidly admitted he was not aware of the law, and I don't think that there should be a lot of argument that that's not deficient performance. The state conceded that in the Court of Appeals and then argued in this court, changed their mind, but I hope the court really doesn't take that too seriously, because I don't believe that because he can show, you know, 7 or 8 or 10 cases where the participants apparently didn't know the rules, that we're going to transform that into our norm, our standard of practice for criminal defense attorneys.
Does this court have the authority to respond to these facts by upholding the conviction, but not as a repeater?
Well, I don't know whether I'd like to say yes or no, but I think I have to say no. I mean, this issue goes directly to the validity of the conviction, and whether he was a persistent repeater or whether this was his first offense is not directly at issue as a result of the issue itself.
Isn't it the repeater element that triggers the extra peremptory challenges?
Well, it does, but even if you eliminated the repeater element, he was still entitled to 5, and he only got 4. Because that's why I don't, you know, in their brief they point out, well, if it was just a normal felony, he'd only got 4, so what's the problem? Well, you know, it's not a normal felony, and this legislature has decided he's entitled to more. Even if it were a normal felony, he would be entitled to 5, not 4, because there was an additional juror seated, what we used to call an alternate, we no longer do. So he would have been entitled to 5. And I do want it clear, obviously I have facts where he was entitled to 7, he only got 4. That makes it more egregious. He's got a particular juror who sat as the foreperson who he identified that he would want to strike. That makes it more egregious. But the rule, the underlying rule that should govern all of these, I don't think is dependent on those specific kinds of facts. The rule is, as it was in Swing, as it was in Ramos, as it is in a lot of cases, the denial or impairment of the peremptory challenge is prejudicial, and its reversal is required. And under those circumstances, I think even one, being deprived of one peremptory, which this court in Ramos said was enough, is enough. And I think really, to get at the prejudice prong of this in an ineffective case, all you really need is an attorney who says, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, this wasn't tactical, and I would have taken more peremptories, I would have struck more people, because I don't think that you could really put a burden on trial counsels to identify 6 months later at a post-conviction hearing a particular juror that they would have struck. In this case, this case stuck in my trial counsel's mind, and because at the time this was like the second or third individual in the entire state that had been subject to what's known as the three strikes law. So he remembered. But what's critical for this is simply the denial of the right, unintelligent waiver, and the decision to have.
In Ramos, I look at Ramos, and I mean, I have no problem saying, yeah, there was a denial. They asked for it, and they didn't get it. Here, they didn't ask for it. I mean, we can read Ramos very narrowly.
Yes, you can. But we have a doctrine called ineffective assistance of counsel. And this clearly, I don't think this court could find that this was not deficient performance.
Right.
Then you move on to prejudice. And there are, and I've cited them in my brief, and this court will have to make its decision as to what does prejudice mean. And assuming I can't prove what you say it means, are you gonna give people trials where they object and say you don't have to show prejudice, but deny it to defendants who are saddled with ineffective attorneys and say, well, you do have to prove prejudice. But we know you can't, so it's either you just can't win. Then these cases would be automatic affirmances, is what they would be. And I hate the term automatic reversal. You know, it makes it sound like, you know, somebody forgot to cross a T and you get a new trial. I mean, automatic reversal, I mean, these are serious errors in these cases. The peremptories are very important to people who are facing jury trials. It's not...
Even though you wind up with a fair jury.
Correct.
Wouldn't this be a carbon copy of Ramos if Juror Lang should have been dismissed for cause?
If what?
If Juror Lang should have been dismissed for cause.
That issue is two separate issues. The state is appealing. The trial Judge Barland granted me a new trial on the ineffective assistance case, the issue of not getting 7 peremptories. New trial has already been granted by Judge Barland. They're the appellant on that issue. He found the lawyer ineffective. He found the prejudice should be presumed under these circumstances. The second issue, which I then appeal, once they appeal, then I raise that. That second issue is Ramos on all fours. It's just the facts are different as to whether the juror should or should not have been discharged for cause, but the issue is identical.
Give us your best shot on Juror Lang.
Juror Lang should have been dismissed for cause because she could not sincerely state that she was willing to put aside the bias that she expressed. She was the victim of a sexual assault when she was, it was either 12 or 13 years old. She testified that it might be hard for her to hear the evidence in this case and to be fair. She testified that it was something she would never forget. The trial judge made a finding that it happened. You know, she was in her 60s, and this happened when she was 12, and it was a long time ago, and she didn't seem to be upset about it, and made some references to her demeanor and how she answered the questions. But my position is, once she expressed that type of bias, and once it's so intimately tied to the issue at this trial, this gentleman was on trial for sexually assaulting a 12, 13-year-old and enticing an 11-year-old, that she has to do more than say, I think so, when asked if she can be fair and impartial. And I equate it to the probably answer of Farron, and that it doesn't, it's the first prong of Farron. That is that, I agree with the state, this is not a case where I'm trying to argue that her bias should be implied. Even though she said she could be fair, you should strike her because she's the victim of a sexual assault. That's not my argument. My argument is she didn't say she could be fair. She said, I think so. And I think so is, I think so, but I'm not sure. I think so is like maybe. And to me, that's a Farron and Ramos issue. And I would ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court to grant Mr. Erickson a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cushing. Mr. Lunston, you have several minutes for rebuttal.
Picking up where he left off, there's a big difference between I think so and I think so. And you have to assume what he said. You have to assume, you really do have to assume that the trial judge who heard that juror speak heard the juror say, I think so, with conviction in their voice. If you don't make that sort of assumption, all hell will break loose.
Isn't that Farron?
No, I don't think it's Farron, because in Farron you had a lot of buildup to that, I believe. So, I mean, I think Farron was wrongly decided. Obviously, I was on the other side of that case, because I think that if you'd given proper deference to the judge, then it's possible that juror had been brought around. But at least in Farron, there was good reason to doubt that that's how that juror said it. In this case, we don't have reason to doubt that this juror had that sort of demeanor, and we have a finding to that effect. The juror had an appropriate demeanor.
How do you respond to Mr. Cushing's argument that, gee, Ramos is well-settled law around the country? Seventh Circuit, the U.S. Supreme Court, a lot of other states, they all agree with us on Ramos. Do you agree with that statement?
I would love to see his research on that point. I haven't recently updated this area, but at the time Ramos was decided, we had roughly an even split among states that had decided the issue. There was no majority one way or the other among the states. And of the federal circuits that had addressed the issue, most had ruled in the state's favor. So if there's a vast majority now in favor of Ramos, that's new. And I don't think it's true. Recently, Texas reversed their position. They had been a Ramos state, saw the error of their way, I think, and they reversed their position, and they are now, contrary to Ramos.
How many states are we talking about?
Pardon me?
How many states are we talking about? 5 or 30?
No, I think maybe 30 states at the time of Ramos had decided the issue. It was something like 15-15. If there's a vast majority now, that is news to me, and I would be interested to see it. But in any event, I don't think you should take, pardon me?
Seventh Circuit, what have they done?
I don't think Seventh Circuit has squarely ruled on it, but again, it's not something I've looked at recently. They had, in prior cases, indicated that that's the way they would rule if it was squarely before them. If it has happened, I haven't seen it, but it might have.
Rule for the state, is that what you're telling us, the Seventh Circuit?
Pardon me? What did you say?
You said that the Seventh Circuit would rule if it were faced with the issue. How would it rule?
The last I looked, their indication was they would rule along the lines of Ramos.
Okay.
But it's important to realize that this is not a constitutional issue. When you issued your ruling in Ramos, it was not a due process ruling. You had complete freedom to rule in Ramos in any manner you wanted to define peremptory strikes the way you wanted to, and could have ruled in either direction. One thing that I've been in front of you saying before is that Ramos is not a due process case. If anything is clear in Ross v. Oklahoma, if anything is clear, it's that the Oklahoma approach was constitutional. And Oklahoma is a non-Ramos state.
So we had two choices in Ramos, I take it. One was to hold it on statutory due process. What was the other, and which did we choose?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I think you just said that Ramos, we were free to go either way.
Yes.
And we did not find a constitutional violation.
Right.
We just found a statutory violation.
Statutory
violation.
If
there's a statutory violation, isn't there a question of statutory due process?
If the Wisconsin courts denied a litigant what they're entitled to under the Wisconsin statutes,
which we said,
and you affirm that, a defendant might take that up to the federal courts and say, Wisconsin has denied me what the Wisconsin statutes allow that I should have. And that litigant might raise a due process claim. And the federal courts might look down on it, as was suggested in Ross v. Oklahoma, and decided on due process grounds. But in Ramos, you could have gone either way. No due process consideration required that you go one way or the other. You were making...